The following is a podcast by the Korean Canadian Medical Association. Our goal is to improve the health of our community through mentorship, networking, and professional development opportunities. The opinions expressed by the speakers are their own and do not necessarily represent the opinion of the KCMA or its affiliates.
So, now we're going to introduce you to Dr. John. We're truly honored to have him with us today to deliver a speech. And just a short bio on Dr. Jung, as short as it can probably be, although that's not even that short. So Conor Jung completed his medical degree in 1984 at the University of Toronto. He received his Master of Arts in Leadership from the Royal Rose University in 2005. He retired from the Canadian Forces in 2012 after 31 years of service to Canada. In his semi-retired role, he runs a Veterans Medical Clinic, providing direct health care to retired Canadian Forces members in Ottawa. As a physician leader, Commander Jung has had many leadership roles in the Canadian Forces throughout his career, ultimately becoming the most senior healthcare leader in the Canadian Forces as a Surgeon General and the Commander of the Canadian Forces Health Services Group. He was responsible for comprehensive healthcare of military personnel, including rehab and mental health programs both in Canada and abroad in operational settings. Commander Jung, being of Korean heritage, was the first and only Canadian of visible minority group to become the Surgeon General and a General Flagger office in the Canadian Forces history. His personal journey and professional accomplishment is an inspiration to generations of Korean Canadians as we work together to build a stronger community. Now, I do have a little tidbit about Dr. Jung as well. I first got to know him when I, for some reason, as a high school student, looked up greatest immigrants to Canada of all time. And his name popped up. So that's how I got to know him. And then I kind of learned more about him and that he was actually very instrumental in implementation of the physician assistant in Canada. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. John.
Introduction. Mr. Kenny, it's an absolute pleasure to see you again. When you consider how much negative publicity that our politicians get, having known and worked beside them, they're probably the most underappreciated group in Canadian society. And that is truly, talking about public service, I mean, it's a very thankless job. So I thank you for your public service. Colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, it's an absolute pleasure to be here today, and I'm honored to be asked to speak at this gala. And I understand the sort of theme for this gala was leadership. So my topic for today is a perspective in leadership. And the topic is a perspective because it is just one perspective. And it's my perspective. And it is so the narrative I'm going to talk about today is really about my upbringing, my experience, my training, and how all these factors have shaped me to pursue a path, or maybe not pursue is not the right word, but directing me to a path of my career in the military for 31 years and to a leadership role. So it is not a treatise on leadership per se. That is a huge topic. There's no way you can cover that in one setting, in 1 hour or less. And I speak to you not as an academic, but really as a practitioner in a leadership role. And this leadership role is by no means a generalized role. It is my experience, my personal journey through a singular context of a military leadership, and in that context even then also further narrowed into military physician leadership. So it may not be generalizable to any other individual or any other scenario, but I suspect there'll be some points that are transferable to other areas and perhaps into your own individual futures, particularly for the medical students and younger physicians in the group. So it is a perspective. Now, studying something is fundamentally different from doing something. And so you can study all you like about medicine, or you can study all you want about leadership, but practicing medicine and practicing leadership are two fundamental different things from knowing. Knowing versus doing are very, very different. And when I look back, I can identify my first real experience in leadership. And mind you, at the time, I didn't think of it that way. But in reflecting, I can reflect back to when I was 11 years old, my first leadership role, if you like. And this was when I was 11 years old, 1970, and we were in Winnipeg. Our family immigrated to Canada in 1970. I was 11 years old. And we came to Canada in January the 18th, cold Winnipeg. And of course, we didn't have any Winnipeg clothes. And in those days, airports didn't have these gangways where they're covered. You have to get out outside and on this ladder and you've got to get out. And I remember my first impression of Canada, I remember stepping up to the door, just about to get down the stairs. I kind of stopped, took my first breath of Canadian air. And it was so cold, my nose stuck together. And that's something it's so seared in my mind, and it was very, very cold. When we came to Canada, there was this wonderful program, even in 1970, where they had a special school called ESL, English as a Second Language. So we had to go to this, and my younger sister and I were enrolled in this, and my father took us to the school once, and we had to take a bus, and the bus had a transfer point. And the next day, we were on our own. So we went out, and as being the older brother, and anybody who's Korean, and perhaps a lot of the Asians would identify, age has certain prestige, certain benefits, but also certain responsibility. So as the older brother, it was my job to navigate our way to school. And being the second day of school and not knowing a word of English, never mind reading, my father gave me the names of the buses that I was supposed to take on a piece of paper. First bus was simple because it was more or less close to the house, so you get in and you have to go to a transfer point. You have to get out and take a transfer. First day, on my own with my younger sister, I'm there trying to find the next bus. Of course, every single bus was a hieroglyphics. I couldn't, what's an A? So I had to figure out A was upstroke, downstroke, with a picture. So I had to literally compare a picture on my piece of paper to the bus headings to try to figure out which bus to take. And sure enough, I found the bus that had the exact same picture as the one my father gave me. We got on. And 5 minutes down, bus driver starts changing the name of the bus. Now, in those days, it wasn't digital. There was a little thing that the bus driver rolled and he changes it. And I said, that is not good. And sure enough, it changed. And now I'm inside the bus looking backwards, saying, that is not the same bus name that I'm supposed to take. So I take my thing out, and I said, sure enough, that is incorrect. My father was smart enough to give me a second piece of paper. If you get lost, give this to the bus driver. So I went to the bus driver, showed him, and he said, I don't know what he said, but I got the impression that you're on the wrong bus. And he pulled out 2 transfer tickets, and he said, get off. This is what I understood, sign language, take the next bus or whatever. So we got off, sure enough, next bus, I looked at it, it seemed the right one, got to school. And the principal was waiting, very concerned, because they're supposed to be there, we're about 40 minutes late, and he was very concerned. And I thought, what a wonderful country, people do this for you, they have a special school, the principal's worried. And then, after that, every day got easier, because you get more familiar. About a month later, my older sister, who was going to a different school, transferred to the same school. I went to the school with her one day, and from then on, I slept all the way. Because what I realized was, when I was carefully watching the bus signs, and watching every single stop, to look for signs when I should ring the bell to get off, my younger sister was sound asleep, both to the school and back, because it was not her responsibility. As the older, I was responsible, and I was accountable for that action. It was automatic. It was a cultural thing, and as an older brother, I was responsible. And when my older sister joined, after one day, I was out like. And looking back, that was leadership. Because leadership is about responsibility and accountability. You have to be, you're responsible and accountable for your actions. And when you think back, then that was my first sort of leadership where I was accountable and responsible. And it's, you know, it sounds perhaps a little bit trite there, but that's basically my first introduction to leadership, in that to be a true leader, you have to be accountable and responsible. Now, in 1970, when we came to Canada, and if you look at the Stats Canada statistics, only 2% of the Canadian population were visible when they were in the official home. Today, it's about 20%. 2011 census. And the term visible minority now is a bit of an oxymoron if you live in Toronto or Vancouver, because visible minority are the majority in Toronto and Vancouver. So the term visible minority is very different than it was in 1970 versus 2014. And with only 2% of the population, there was no enclaves or ghettos. And my father was very clear, we came to Canada to be Canadians, not to be Koreans living in Canada, but rather to be Canadians, and to integrate and assimilate into the Canadian society as much as possible, learn English as fast as possible, and become a productive Canadian citizen. Now that is very much a culture of Korean culture, you know. Hard, as Minister Kenny talked about, work ethic. It is inbred into you. And I suspect it's not just Korean, it's a lot of the Asian, and frankly, many of the world's cultures. Work, hard work, and self-sufficiency is very much embedded in the culture. And that was the premise that I grew up in. And as a youngster, I can't remember exactly what age, but I do remember listening to a radio announcement of President John F. Kennedy's speech one day. And the part that really caught my attention, which I had sort of kept with me throughout my career and my life, and sort of the credo that I tried to live by, was when President Kennedy said, "Do not ask what this country can do for you, but ask what you can do for this country." So the sense of it is your responsibility to work hard and make something of yourself, rather than running to the country or whatever system there is and say, "Hey, I'm entitled, give me what I'm due." The idea that you have to work hard at whatever profession or trade that you choose to work for and to succeed at what you're doing, rather than demanding that somebody give you what you're entitled to because you couldn't potentially achieve what you aspire to do. So self-sufficiency was something that is definitely part of my family culture. I think it was part of the Korean culture, and I think it's part of not only the Asian culture, but many of the great cultures around the world where you really have to work hard to achieve what you really aspire to be. So that was something that very much part of my younger life. And one of the things that I guess I took out of that was Canada truly provided an opportunity, what I call a sense of maybe not equal opportunity, but an opportunity nonetheless. But it was the opportunity that you had to work at, because nowhere did it promise equal outcome. You know, your outcome was dependent upon your working that opportunity. And remember, in 1970, Korea was a developing country, really a third world country. And when we left, and my father came over to do postgraduate studies, we never meant to stay. He was the only here to study. But when he came here, realized what a great country it was and what an opportunity it would be for his children, so we stayed as an immigrant. But because of the developing country, the Korean government only allowed us to leave the country with $100. That's all we came to Canada with. We didn't have anything else. $100. And the idea of going on welfare or anything like that was out of the question. I mean, that would be complete embarrassment and complete admission that you could not, you were becoming a burden to the society. And we came to this country, nobody forced us to come. We came. And nobody wanted to be a burden to the society. We wanted to be a productive citizen of society to work really, really hard, getting to whatever you wanted to do. In my case, it was medicine, but it doesn't matter. Whatever you wanted to do, you have to work hard and make something of yourself so that you become a positive contribution to the society rather than a drain. That was something that was built, inbred into our genetics, if you like. And I think, given all of you here, I suspect that is very much the same for all of you. So 1970s, when we grew up, so that's my childhood, if you like. And it was, you know, it was not easy. Only 2% of the population, many of the benefits that a lot of the New Yorkers take for granted today didn't exist. Okay? And, you know, and when you're only 2%, there was a lot more overt, let's say, racism and discrimination that went on. But I don't ever recall feeling sorry for myself, you know? I never recall saying, well, I'm going to complain to somebody to get my rights. It was always, I'll show them by being better than they are. So you have to just work harder to prove to everybody else that their discrimination or their perspective, their stereotype was wrong. And that has been my way of coping with whatever challenges that come my way. I'm not saying it's the only way, I'm not saying it's the best way, but it's my way of overcoming everything, not to go complain to somebody, but rather simply show them that they were wrong by overcoming and doing better than they would do themselves. So hard work was bred into the system. And after 10 years of growing up in Canada, in 80, I was accepted to UMC Medical School. Very lucky, I guess. And I applied after my second year in university. I actually got accepted, and they asked for an interview after they got accepted, you know. And I thought that was a bit bizarre. No interview. Thank goodness it was after the fact, because I think I probably failed the interview. But I got in, and it was, and that sort of changed my life in many ways, I guess. But the moment I got my acceptance letter, and this was in Ottawa, I went down to the recruiting center to join the military, and they said, "No, can do. One exception." And I said, "Why?" They said, "Well, because the rules are you have to finish 1 year of medical school in those days before you could be accepted as a medical officer candidate in the military at the time." They were, I guess they wanted to know you had the wherewithal to succeed after 1 year before they would take you on. And remember, these were the days without internet. So my motive to join the military had nothing to do with money. I mean, I think I'm almost positive I'm probably the only person in the Canadian Forces who joined the military not for money. I joined because it's something that I felt I needed to do. What better way to show your gratitude than to serve in the country and protect the values that has accepted you into Canada in the first place? So you can't research all the things that are available. You have to actually go down and physically look at paperwork. And I couldn't even look at those paperwork. I just signed and said, I want to serve. And it was my intent was to only serve 3 years. And that time, the initial engagement was 3 years after you graduated. And then they told me then that, oh, by the way, we'll pay for your tuition. I said, ooh, great. You know, that was a bonus. And then they said, oh, by the way, we'll also pay you $800. $100 a year just to go to medical school. That's fantastic. And then, of course, I got $800 next month. So it was $800 a month at the time, not $800 a year. You know, so it was fantastic. So, I mean, I didn't know any of that. I was going to join anyway, just to serve and spend 3 years, and that was my payback. You know, I said, thank you, you know, for letting me be in Canada and go to medical school. And I was going to get out, actually, you know, after that. Because in medical school, I really enjoyed microvascular and reconstructive surgery. That's what I wanted to do, go back to residency. But then, you know, things get in the way. And, you know, you spend 3 years in the military, and I spent some time at sea, going sailing around the Pacific Ocean. And suddenly you realize, you know, you're having fun. And why would you want to do something different if you're having fun? But I actually called up my so-called career manager and said, you know, I think I'm going to leave. And then they said, how would you like to go to Germany? And I said, well, I'll get back to that. So I talked to my wife, and she said, let's go. And that's how we ended up sort of, and then that initial 3 years turned out to be a 31-year career. But the military career has been, you know, really, really fantastic for me. I've enjoyed every moment. And I'm not saying it's not, there are no frustrations. Every job and every profession is frustration. But on the whole, it's been a very fulfilling career. Because of the military, either directly or indirectly, I've been able to go to over 27 different countries around the world. And every time I go and I come back to Canada, Canada is home. You know, the more you travel, the more you appreciate Canada. And for those of you who have never left Toronto, by God, go somewhere. Because the more you travel, the more you will appreciate what Canada has to offer. You know, and it's just amazing. You know, I've been to every Middle East, you know, all over Europe, okay, and in many different places. And, you know, even such places as Switzerland and Austria, Finland, you know, it sounds like wonderful places, but, you know, to me, they're not home. It's a great place to visit, but this is home. And so that ability to travel has been fantastic. And interestingly, in the 70s, the recruiting model at the time was join the forces, see the world. And in fact, that's what I've done. And it's been a tremendously eye-opening and a rewarding experience, but also re-emphasizes what a great country Canada really is. And I encourage all of you to travel, if not around the world, but at least travel within Canada to realize what a diverse and wonderful country this really is. So I don't see myself as a Winnipegger or an Ottawa, since I grew up most of the time there. And I don't even see myself as an Ontarian. You know, I truly see myself as a citizen of Canada. And I see myself as a Canadian, not as a Korean Canadian, but as a Canadian of Korean heritage, proud heritage of Korea, but a Canadian. And having served in the Canadian forces, having gone to war, I dare anybody to tell me I'm not a Canadian. Okay? So it's been a tremendous experience. And one of the things I really enjoyed, I guess partly, one of the other reasons from a career-wise, as a physician, why I stayed in the military was, as I stayed in the military, and as the military gave me some authority and leadership responsibility, I realized that I could do a lot more as a leader than as a singular physician. I mean, and I'm not by any means downplaying the role of a physician. I mean, as a physician, you do great service to your patients, you know, one-on-one. But when you look at your opportunity to influence the population, as a leader in that system, to really leverage what you would want to do for your individual patients to the larger population had a great appeal to me. And so that's really one of the reasons why the leadership initially became appealing as a feature venue to go into, to really see what can I do for the larger population than just my individual patients. And the other thing military provided to me was a sense of meritocracy. Military is very much merit-driven, because either you or your boss gets posted about every 3 years. So there's nobody, one person, a family dynasty, whatever, who can use their nepotism to move and promote their friends. You don't have a boss more than about 2 years, because either you or your boss moves. So a new person comes along, and everybody wants to do, in their short tenure of their whatever role, the best they can. And so to do that, you're driven to surround yourself with the best people, not your family, friends, or your, you know, people you know. And so as somebody, you know, who really didn't have any connections, I found that very refreshing to be recognized for what you do and be rewarded and promoted based upon your merit rather than who you know. And those are some of the reasons why military and the opportunity for leadership truly appealed to me to stay in the military, continue on, and develop that as a career over the next 31 years. So let me just go now on more about, broadly speaking about my perspective on leadership, or my understanding of the leadership, if you like, and then move that into leadership in the military, leadership in the sort of healthcare sector, and then military and leadership in the military healthcare sector, and sort of conclude as my knowledge and my experience have given me. One of the things that I said with leadership is really about being responsible and accountable for what you do, for the people you are leading. most people in positions of authority initially start off with positional authority. You know, their authority is given to them by their position. You may have authority given your title, but that doesn't mean you're a leader. To have a leader, you have to have followers who respect you and who value your credibility. So when you exercise authority, but you have no sense of responsibility or accountability for the people or the activity you're doing, that's a sheer exercise in power, not leadership. And so leadership is really about leading people, getting their respect, not necessarily being liked, but gaining their respect and being held responsible and accountable for your actions. And it is really, leadership is really an art and a science. And I see leadership as very much like sports. I knew from a very young person, I would never be a Usain Bolt. Okay? I was never going to be a super, you know, athlete in that sense. So people are born with certain talents, like athletic talents. And my experience with leadership is that people are born with certain leadership talent too. But just as super athletes need to refine their skills to become really great through very vigorous training and dedication and perseverance, leaders have to be educated, trained, build on their experience, and continue to grow that way. It doesn't come naturally. You don't just naturally arrive and become a great leader. And leadership really, in my mind, comes across particularly during times of crisis, stress, or big change. That's when leaders are truly required, and some leaders step up. When things are more or less stable, that's more management. Status quo is you need a good, strong management skills when things are status quo, but when there's crisis, stress, or big change requirement, you really need a leader to guide you the way. So, let me talk about military leadership in general. Most of you think about military leadership classically in terms of combat, and it's true. I mean, military leaders, especially in Afghanistan, you know, they train for that. They train their whole life to lead in combat under stress, under crisis, and definitely a lot of change. But I think, based upon my experience, leadership in the military, and particularly in combat, as potentially physically harmful as it might be to your health, it is somewhat easier to do than in a civilian setting. Because military people have a mission. The government gives the military a mission. You know what the mission is. And if you're in a war or a conflict, you know who your enemy or adversary is. You know your objective. And everybody in that team knows that you have to accomplish the mission. And people rise to the challenge, and they're trained their whole career for that particular moment. They develop muscle memory, both in terms of how to handle the weapon, but also muscle memory of the kind and the cerebral kind, how to react, how to lead, how to adapt. And so as much as that may sound heroic or dangerous and difficult, I actually think it's somewhat easier, because you have a defined mission, and you train for that role. Whereas in a civilian context, whether it's military or civilian leaders, particularly for the military, if you don't have a mission, it's a little vague. You don't know who your adversary is. You don't know who your enemy is. What is your mission? And then, in a combat situation, you have clear rules of engagement, as you call them. You know, if X happens, you're able to do Y and Z. But in civilian context, there's no rule book as such. And the ethics are a little bit more vague. And there are way too many competing interests. Whereas in combat, there are no competing interests. That is the mission, and every competing interest has to go by the wayside to accomplish that mission. In the civilian context, you have to weigh various competing interests and try to find the right course of action. And there's no single course of action that is correct. And even if you did one, there are 10 people telling you it's wrong. So civilian context is much more difficult in my mind than in the military context. So, but in the military leadership, as I said, it is about meritocracy. People rise up the military hierarchy through merit, as I talked about, and it is a truly bottom-up organization. You cannot become a general but because you had some experience in some IBM corporation. Doesn't matter who you are, you start at the bottom of the rung and you pay your dues and you work your way up so that you develop credibility. So when you're leading a young captain or lieutenant, he or she knows that you were there 20 years ago. So there's a credibility of being in the trenches, having paid your dues, and that actually is part of the military leadership ethos. But the whole time you're in the military, you have two competencies you have to develop. There's a competency in your profession, be it whether you're an engineer, you're an infantry officer, you're a logistics officer, finance officer, whatever. You have to be good at your chosen profession. And then you have to be just as proficient in leadership. And your whole career, you're trained continually on higher and higher levels of leadership, from small teams to groups, to larger groups, to formations, and so on. So you are, military leadership is really trained from the moment you enter the military to the moment you retire to take on greater and greater responsibility. And one of the things you realize in the military is that there is no confusion who is leading. You may have all heard the term pointy end. The pointy end, by definition, is the point that is the profession, if you like, that does the bulk of the fighting. So in infantry, it's called combat arms. They do the fighting. And then there are, so in the military, you can group, subdivide people in two groups, combat arms and support. So in the army, it's the artillery, the armored corps, the infantry, and so on. In the Navy, it is the naval officers. In the Air Force, it is the air crew, mostly pilots. And then there are support people, like logistics, who get the fuel, the food, the ammunition, and healthcare people who provide support in case they're attacked. Now, no one in the military, or in fact, anybody, I think, would confuse the raison d'etre for the military. It is there to fight. Military does not exist to give physicians, patients, to provide medical advantage, right? That's not what the military exists for. So in the military, there's absolutely clear, there's no confusion who leads. It's the combat arms people. They're the ones who fight, they're the ones who lead the fighting. And all the support people provide support to them. So logistics people and physicians don't compete with the combat arms people saying, hey, we should be leading the military. Everybody knows that they lead the military, we're supporting them. So it's called a pointy end. And even though the pointy end infantry officer, let's say, is leading, if something goes wrong, they're accountable because they're responsible and accountable. It's called a single point of accountability. There's no such thing as a committee. Even if they have nothing to do with it, if something goes wrong under your watch, you're accountable and you take responsibility for that action. Not, you don't blame it on somebody else. So that's called single point of accountability and military leadership in that context. Very singular, I think, in any kind of organization context. So let's look at that military leadership context to the medical world in general. Who's the pointy end in the medical world? Well, you know, if you ask nurses, they'll say, nobody will say doctors. Okay? They'll say, well, we're all equals. They all talk about collaboration, you know, collaboration of equals. I've never seen any kind of organization where there's not a leader. And whenever they say there isn't one, that's not true. Even fancy IT organizations, everybody knows who the boss is. There is orchestras have a leader, even jazz organizations have a usual leader who determines the direction. There's always a leader. But in the medical world, in this very touchy-feely world of medicine, everybody wants to be a leader. Everybody wants to be equal. So who's the pointy end here? Well, it occurred to me very early that physicians are poignant in the healthcare system. I mean, do physicians exist to provide prescriptions for the pharmacists? No. Do physicians exist to provide diagnosis and treatment options for the nurses? Do physicians exist to provide lab tests for the lab people? No. To me, it's very, very common, but in the politically correct world of today, everybody's talking about we're all equal and we should all be working collaboratively where no one is better than anybody else. Of course, when you do that, and something goes wrong, everybody points the finger at somebody else. And so it's very difficult to find who's accountable for healthcare actions in Canada if something goes wrong. And that's something that there was something that didn't seem right to me when I was in the military system and as a medical officer in the military system. There's too much competition within the healthcare profession as to who should be leading, rather than working as a team with a sense of who is the de facto leader. Now that the leader doesn't have to be so omnipresent every day to tell everybody I'm the leader. But there is a general shift. I mean, an infantry officer doesn't have to tell me that he's the leader. I know. I'm the support. But he knows that if an infantry goes to fight and the medical world isn't there to look after his troops, his soldiers won't fight. Because they fight in Afghanistan, and we've suffered the kind of casualties we have because they know if they get injured, they would get the top-notch medical care that is humanly possible. That confidence gives them the willingness to go put their self in risk and go fight and potentially lose their lives, lose their legs, lose their arm, and all kinds of consequences. And I know this because the infantry soldiers themselves and the leaders have told me, my soldiers wouldn't go out there if you guys weren't there to back us up. So when you're not a leader, it doesn't mean you're less important. But you just have to know where you fit in and be comfortable with who you are and not have a chip on your shoulder all the time saying, well, I want to be a leader. So that's the kind of context that I've sort of grown up in the military that I've developed. Now, military medicine is not devoid of division medicine. I mean, it's not a complete, we're not living in a vacuum. So, for the longest time, military medicine was led by physicians. Why? Well, just because it was. I'm sure in the olden days, all the hospitals were led by physicians. But lo and behold, after a while, the life gets a little more complex. And you know what? A lot of military physician leaders weren't all that great leaders or managers. They didn't know anything about business planning. They didn't know about strategic planning. They didn't know about how politics worked. They knew medicine. They didn't really know how medicine fit into the greater military and how the military Department of National Defense, the Canadian Forces fit into the Department of National Defense, how the Department of National Defense fits into the overall government of Canada, and how military fits in with various provincial organizations that it may relate to or support it sometimes. So this lack of credibility that over time became also acknowledged in the military, very much like it was in the civilian sector. So instead of the hospitals being run by doctors, they hired CEOs, administrative CEOs, who were not doctors. And that was a trend that took place in the 90s and late 80s, really started to go from there. Same thing happened in the military. In 2000, they finally decided we had enough, doctors were not very competent, we're going to let them do medicine. And we'll let the leadership and management be done by professionals. So they installed professional military healthcare administrators as CEO equivalent, and commanders of the medical organization. And the doctor was left to as an advisor. Not just at the top, but throughout the chain. And that did a number of things. Sure enough, management became much more clear. I don't say more efficient, because sometimes management leads to more management, but management became very much focused, and it actually was very good in that way. Business planning was clear, strategic planning became a little bit more clear. But the whole clinical team, not just physicians, but all the clinicians became disenfranchised. They were second-class citizens, because resource was the primacy, and the clinicians had to do whatever was available as dictated by the resource management. And this created a huge cultural rift and dissent within the organization. It also created a number of other things. It kind of turned the medical organization a bit confused. What is our raison d'etre? Is it to provide healthcare or is it to manage resources? And there was a lot of difficult internal angst that went on. And as I say, leadership is required in combat and sometimes stress. And sure enough, whether by chance or not, this opportunity arose. And the other thing I guess was that when you had a CEO that was a civilian, that was an administrator, and a certain general who was medical advisor, whenever something went wrong, and I use that term sort of diffusely, nobody knew who was responsible. The administrator would say, well, it's not me. I said, that's clinical care. That's somebody else. And the certain general said, well, I can only do with what resources I had. It's not my problem. And so what I call the singular point of accountability in the military that has existed failed. You have two people pointing fingers at each other saying, not my problem. And that was something that military leadership did not like. And of course, by this time, the Afghan war started. And the leadership wanted combat medicine. They wanted healthcare. They wanted field hospital. They wanted treatment. And they wanted recommendations and advice. And management didn't really figure into this very much. It was all about military physician leadership. Because everybody realized at that point that in a combat medicine situation, the pointy end in the healthcare was physician leadership. So that's when it really came to the light of everybody beyond the medical world that the confusion as to who's leading the medical world had to be reset. And let me just go to you a little bit about the healthcare system in the military. So, you know, military healthcare is truly the 14th healthcare jurisdiction in Canada. But it is not run by any of the provinces or territories. Military healthcare system exists because of the Canada Act, the National Defense Act, and the Canada Health Act. It is a federal jurisdiction. All the clinicians work under federal jurisdiction, not province. In theory, we don't need any license from the province whatsoever. But we're trying to create a federal regulatory framework for doctors, nurses, physicians, dentists, pharmacists, and so on would be impossible. So federal government chooses to use one of the provincial systems to accredit its clinicians. And so that's how the military healthcare system is truly a 14th separate jurisdiction. The organization has about 6,400 people, and its budget is somewhere around about $850 million a year. So it's a decent-sized hospital with about 100,000 population that it looks after. Now that sounds like a small number, but we're talking 100,000 people spread across, you know, 10 provinces and 3 territories and deployed at ships and Afghanistan all over the world. We have to provide healthcare to the same standard as in Canada. So trying to manage and lead an organization that diverse, that distributed both time and geography is much more challenging than trying to run a hospital in Toronto where everybody's in one city. Military also, if you're in the military and you stay in a career like I have, it's not just about practicing medicine. Throughout your career, you're trained, you're educated to become a leader. And then you're trained to become a leader. And then you're given opportunities to become a leader. So you start off slow, in a small clinical team, what we call tactical leadership. And if you are a good clinician and you demonstrate good competency as a small team leader, and you demonstrate potential for more, then you're promoted to what we call operational site guardian. And if you show promise there as a good clinician, good leader, and again, potential for more, because some people, we say, oh, you know, this person has done a really good job, but we don't see their potential beyond that. So not only is there a merit system to determine, identify who's got potential to go beyond, we also have a succession planning process. When you identify them, we actually give them the additional training and education and the experience necessary to prove themselves so they can continue to move on. And so this is how you progress in the military, and this is how I have progressed in the military in my 31 years. So I'm happy to say, and I say this without any sense of embarrassment at all or any sense of apology, that in 2009 when I was appointed as a Surgeon General, Commander, and Director General of Health Services, I actually formally merged the leadership of health services into one position. And that one position has Surgeon General attached to it. So until then, leadership in the military was never guaranteed to be a position. It was sort of diffuse and split, there was never a true sense of singularity or accountability. But when I took over, very soon after, with the selecting of the leadership, we actually, they recognize the poignant nature and requirement for strong physician leadership. So we merged, so we created a, we actually rewrote, if you like, the terms of reference for the Surgeon General so that now he can only be a physician leader who leads the military healthcare services. So it's one of the things that I've done, among a number of other things. Very proud of. Some people, obviously, not particularly happy about that because he made physician to be first among equals, if you like, rather than, you know, equal and collaborating. But, you know, you have to have a leader somewhere. And unless you identify that, subsequent medical officers won't know that that's a potential. So now every junior medical officer will know that if they want to be a leader, not only have to be a good clinician, they have to take courses in leadership, management, and prove themselves along the way so that they can actually lead an organization within a system, not just patient care, it's a system. And so, you know, my conclusion through my experience was that you know, physicians are natural and logical choice to lead a healthcare system. And, you know, that's probably not necessarily the politically correct comment to be made in Canadian society at present time. But my experience has told me that there's no better way. I'm not saying it's the only way, but with the appropriate physician that is trained, educated, with the right experience level, to lead, there can be no better person to lead a complex system of healthcare, because only that person can truly balance and develop a compromise between clinical requirements and resource limitations. Anybody can lead in a utopian world where there's no limitation on resources, but that's not the world we live in. And who better to know where the compromise can be made than a physician who has a global perspective. And who knows what it means to be, when you talk about quality of care, the physician knows. A professional administrator can talk about that, but no patient has died in front of that administrator personally because of their actions or inactions and so on. So it is a very, very fundamental thing that I find that physicians need. And physicians need to you know, step up to the plate and take a leadership role. But it's not easy. Because there are a number of challenges for physicians taking leadership role. Now, I would say that this pattern is slightly changing in the last decade or so. Because if you look at some of the major hospitals, some huge hospitals in Canada are now led by physician CEOs. But that wasn't the case usually. But when physicians think about taking on leadership role, there's this idea of they're going to the dark side. They're abandoning their chosen profession, that they're abandoning. And or perhaps, you know, they just couldn't cut it in the clinical world. So therefore, they, you know, the second best thing is become a leader in the healthcare system. That mentality was very prevalent in the 80s and early 90s. And I think it's starting to change now. Because even if you look at Canadian Medical Association, and certain medical associations are really promoting physician leadership competence. But it really was true. And that by becoming an administrator leader, you were somehow losing your prestige and respect of your colleagues as a clinician. They were just second tier. And that obviously drove away a lot of people who might have wanted to provide that more population-based healthcare versus individual healthcare. And the other part of leadership is, especially if you take an organization context, it's not a part-time job. You cannot do it part-time by doing, you know, spending, you know, one day a week doing management. It's a full-time job. And you have to, it's not something that you just get there. You have to train, you have to get educated. It's another set of competencies you have to develop on top of your medical competencies. And that's a significant investment of time and effort for physicians to do. So those are many of the issues. And perhaps one of the biggest obstacles is, let's be frank, physicians are lousy followers. Okay. Physicians are trained to challenge, right? I mean, you're taught to be independent thinkers. That you don't, you, just because your staff man said something, if you're a resident, you know, your job is to go read that night, to find some itty-bitty details that you can challenge your staff, and then correct them wrong. So it's this idea of independence, challenge, not necessarily go to group thinking, that whole idea of training and education, that is anathema to organizational team playing. Because when you're in an organization, you know, you can say whatever you want at the right time to provide your views, and when a decision is made, then you go with the leadership. And of course, the military is great at that. The military, contrary to what people believe, there's lots of opportunities to say our piece. But when the leadership makes a decision, right or wrongly, we all march in the same direction. Not like the lemmings, but in a way that is after careful consideration. Okay? And that followership, to me, is as important as leadership. Because for an organization to function, there has to be a reasonable level of followership. And if every single doctor thinks they have the best answer and they know the truth, then the organization at the end of it all suffers. And so these are some of the challenges of being a physician leader. So let me just conclude my rambling here with what I would call four summary points about healthcare, leadership, and medicine. Leadership, no matter what anybody says, is all about timing. You know, different times read or provide opportunities for different leaders to rise to the challenge. You know, look at Winston Churchill, considered to be one of the great leaders in the Second World War, defeated after the war. Because why? Because his style of leadership, his leadership, is not what the population wanted after the war when they wanted to grow in peace. Look at George Bush Sr. You know, he won the Gulf War, but defeated by Clinton because the country wanted something different. You know, so even though they're great leaders in their own right, in their own time, if you're at the wrong place at the wrong time, then your leadership style, your leadership, attributes are not necessarily the best one. So timing is very important. And as somebody who's sort of been in the system and who's, kind of retired slightly earlier than necessary, it's all about timing. You know, you gotta get out when you're on the top of your game, not when people ask you to leave. They don't want to outstay your welcome. So that's really important. I would really, honestly, I'll tell you, leave on a high, know when to retire. Don't have people trying to push you out. And most importantly, when you do that, succession plan. Make sure when you leave, you have trained, mentored other people who can take over. I mean, it'd be lousy for you to leave and leave an empty chair, a vacuum, without the right people, the right training. Because that is not leadership either. That's simply abandonment. You want to leave an organization in the better shape or the good shape you can do and leave it with somebody or a group of people who have the competencies to come after you. That's your job as a leader, to also groom your successors. Another very important thing. Medicine, without a doubt, is evidence-based. That's where we want to be. Healthcare is politics. Too many doctors and medical organizations, in my mind, try to affect healthcare using evidence and these pure logic, when healthcare is all about politics. And as a medical leader, if you do not understand, I'm not saying you should become a politician necessarily, which is good too. I mean, Dr. Couillard, the premier of Quebec, neurosurgeon. Obviously, it'll be very interesting to see how Quebec healthcare evolves over the next few years. But healthcare is politics. Medicine is evidence. And you should not confuse the two. Okay. So, and if you're a leader, remember healthcare is politics. That means you have to know how medicine fits in with the greater system. And it's not all about medicine. It's about how you can meet the political objectives and missions to provide the best value given the realities of resource limitations. Okay? That's healthcare. Medicine is about, you need an MRI? Absolutely, you need an MRI to get it. Whether the organization has an MRI is a healthcare decision. And lastly, I've always, it's not my rule. I heard it somewhere early in my career and I sort of kept it. It's called the golden rule. And you have to always remember the golden rule if you ever want to lead. And the golden rule says, he or she who has the gold rules. Meaning, if you want to change something, you have to have control of the resources. If you don't, you're just an advisor for you to be ignored or not. If you control the resources, you can effect change much more efficiently and effectively. And to have that goal and to have that resources, you have to be a leader. You have to be engaged in systems bigger than medicine. You got to be in healthcare, and you got to be a leader. And you have to understand the whole system, not just medicine, but how the whole system fits in terms of the small p politics, the overall budget issue, how various things affect the government power in the latitude they may or may not have towards healthcare. And you have to work that system so that you can provide an option that is a win-win. It's never a good idea, with all due respect to Mr. Kinney here, doesn't matter which government, which party is in power, it's never a good idea to demonize the government, because they are trying to deal with conflicting demands with limited resources. And you do not want to be one more problem in that equation. If it is, you're not a welcome person. If you go with a solution that provides a win for the government, whichever government, that could be municipal government, could be provincial government, federal government, with a win for your constituency as a physician leader, that's probably going to be the best solution, rather than trying to go for what the evidence says is the best thing, regardless of the resource implications. You may win the battle, but you will lose the war. So, golden rule. So that sort of summarizes my 31 years, a little bit longer if you look at my childhood. But it's been a great career, and it's not finished. I'm retired from the military, but I'm not retired from life. So I am now semi-retired. I have this part-time practice. But the beauty of it is, same thing in your own career. You have to plan on your exit. You know, don't go out and somehow expect retirement to hit you with a golden platter. You have to plan on that exit, particularly for those of you who are over the age of 50. You know, you need to look at your exit plan, your strategic retreat, if you like, and slow down somewhat. You know, and enjoy your life before you're so old that you have all kinds of money, but you don't have the body to enjoy it. You know? So it's all about planning and forethought. So for whatever is worth, thank you for listening.
Well, thank you. You said one perspective of leadership, but that's one heck of a perspective of leadership. You know, you said that, you know, your first experience of leadership was when you first landed in Winnipeg and took the bus. I can relate to that because I'm from Winnipeg. I know the bus system, I know the winter. That's actually a pretty nice day. You mentioned, you know, being that singular point of accountability. I feel a lot better knowing that I actually think of point of accountability that I paid my CMPA dues. If I could actually get you to come back up so that you could be the point of accountability for
association. It's good to see some new friends and all the old friends. And I hope to see more of you and more often in our future fundraisers and other volunteer organizations that we have in our community. And I'd like to congratulate KCMA, the executive, the board members, and the members for putting on such a great event, and also dedicating your organization, your time to nurturing a younger generation and also advancing the health of the Korean-Canadian community. You know how hard it was for your parents to come to a new country, Canada. Sacrifice their own career ambitions so that you can pursue your own aspirations in a better environment. I can see that you have done all well. But I have a question. Do you and I have the same vision and the passion for our future generation? Over the last 30 years that I've worked with many of your parents in the Korean community organizations and learned a lot from them and inspired by them. Not only were they committed to their families, but they were also dedicated to building a strong community. Remember, they didn't have the money like you, or the time for any vacation or leisure time. They were completely committed to raising a good children in good environment. But they had the passion and the vision to establish an organization like Korean Canadian Scholarship Foundation to help young and promising students that were in need. They had the vision and the passion to establish KCWA Family and Social Services to help those women in distress and those new immigrant settlers. And there were so many other organizations that were built to help people that are blind, people with heart conditions, children in poverty, the seniors in need. And also for the vibrancy of the community, they also created organizations. Some of them are here. They have arts organizations. They have we have orchestras, choirs, sports leagues, so many more organizations that help grow the community. And you and I all want to provide the best for our children. And we want them to be healthy, do well in school, move on to find very rewarding jobs, start their own families, and become caring parents and responsible, engaging citizens of the world. But in order to do all that, in order for our kids to be in a healthy and safe environment, to have good schools, to have good jobs for them when they graduate, you and I have to be engaged in community building. The government can't do it all, and they should not do it all by themselves. Citizen engagement is the vital part of building safe neighborhoods, strong communities, and a good society. I know many of you are already engaged in helping the seniors in our community. Some of you are doing regular missions, medical missions, to work in Haiti and South America in some of the poor neighborhoods in some of the poor parts of the world. So I applaud you and applaud your association for taking the leadership and in community engagement. So please continue your hard work and continue to grow your projects. There's so many people in our community and around the world that need your help. And your leadership will inspire many, many young people to follow your footsteps and building a strong communities in Canada and around the world. And I do see very good signs. I see now that KCSF is led by people like Philip Cho. Philip used to call me Uncle Cho, Uncle Sonny in the old days. Now he's leading the Scholarship Foundation. Now KCMA is being led by people like Kidong. And some of the people that are in my kind of age category, but not so engaged with, but nowadays are actively engaged running KCWA, like Mary Choi and Yong Lee Ha, are very good leaders in leading a very good organization in our community. And we also have an organization like Han Voice that are fighting for the human rights for the North Koreans. So, you know, our younger generation is now in leadership. So I feel pretty good about that. So let's work together. Let's build a stronger bond. Let's build that sense of community and sense of togetherness, because that's what's important and that's what will make a difference in our society and our world. So, in closing, thank you and have a good night and hope to see you more often. Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by the Korean Canadian Medical Association. Please visit our website at www.kcma.ca and consider becoming a member.